network at ParanormalKing.com.
Welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for the week of September 4th, 2018. And this is episode number 367. And this is your host, as always, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. And this week, got a jam-packed episode for you tonight. Tonight, we're going to talk about mysterious large cats creeping around Pennsylvania, as well as the state of Maryland. Some weird, interesting camera footage is showing up about this, and we're going to talk in depth about these big cats. We're also going to talk about the big debate in Bigfootery. Yeah, I'll expand on that here in a couple of minutes, and we'll also talk about the winner of the Golden Yeti, who was just announced over the holiday weekend. We'll also talk some UFOs as UFOs invade San Diego, and an IFO falls over Missouri. So that, and not to mention that this week marks the 10-year anniversary of the Paranormal News Insider. Yes, Bigfootery. I think somebody else has used that term. I can't claim it as my own, but I like the concept of, you have cryptozoology and you have Bigfoot is one of the main three here, one of the big three, but I think it deserves its own category within cryptozoology. Just call it Bigfootery so the rest of us can get back to real cryptozoology stuff. Oh, no, don't want to start a war here, but that's just kind of how I feel. Yes, 10 years ago this week. It's insane to think about that. I feel old every time I think about that and all the other stuff I've been and have done over the course of 20 years in the paranormal field, and it's just insane. But before we get into that, again, the events listing for the Paranormal News Insider, if you go to paranewsinsider.com and click on the events tab there at the top, you can see all of the paranormal conferences, conventions that I have lined up on my website. Now, this isn't an all-inclusive list. There are some that I probably don't have on there, and you're probably looking at it going, hey, he's missing the one that I'm going to next week. Yeah, I can't get them all. I try to do as many as I can, and it's been a little busy over the course of the last few weeks. A lot of stuff going on, and I haven't had too much time to update stuff. Celebrated my birthday over the weekend and went out of town, out to Pennsylvania, one of the neighboring states, obviously. I live in Ohio, so just kind of got away for a long weekend, and it just seems like every week kind of gets away from me. So if you know of any conference or convention that I missed on there, please feel free to let me know. You can email me at insider@paranewsinsider.com, or if you go to paranewsinsider.com, there is a contact tab there at the top. You can click on that and get a hold of me and let me know and help me out. You know, help me help you help others find a conference or convention in their neck of the woods. I do ghost conventions, UFO, as well as cryptozoology. And the event, depending upon what a majority of it is where I stick it in this list. So some of these might be ghost events here on this list, but they may have a cryptozoologist or two on there. Some of my appearances that I do sprinkle in there to trick people who like to steal my stuff. They take this list and put it on their website, which is cool because I sneak my stuff in there as well. And a lot of those, I said most of these this year are going to be cryptid-based events. So I'm really looking forward to that. Yes, any kind of conference or convention you have any information for, let me know, and I'll put it on there. And I'll be at quite a few this year. I got one coming up at the end of September, again, on cryptids at the Floyd E. Youngkin branch of the Pickaway County Public Library. That's in Asheville, Ohio, down south in Ohio, south of Columbus, north of Cincinnati area. Then I have some stuff in October, the UnCon 12 Unconventional. That's in Piqua, Ohio. It's a really interesting event. It's not ghost. It's not cryptid. It's not quite UFOs, but it's just a little bit of everything. It's there'll be a lot of people there that have done makeup in movies. One of the people is actually in the Guinness Book of World Records for the number of times he's appeared in makeup in movies. A lot of Star Trek episodes. So you might want to check that out if you're into that kind of stuff. It's a lot of comic book stuff, but also just anything anybody gets into. And I'm going to be excited to be there. It's something a little different. Again, that's October 5th and 6th in Piqua, Ohio. Then the following weekend, I'll be down at the El Batwitch Festival in Columbia, Pennsylvania. That's all the way out there towards Philadelphia. And I'll be hanging out with Tim Renner and Rick Fisher talking about cryptids. And I mentioned it last week. Tickets were going on sale. I know I'm insane. It's only September. But I'm already talking about next May and June, May 31st through June 2nd, the 2019 PA Bigfoot Camping Adventure takes place during that week, May 31st through June 2nd, at the Benner's Meadow Run Campground in Farmington, Pennsylvania. Now, tickets went on sale over the weekend, Friday night, well, I guess Saturday morning, really, at midnight. They're really flying out the door. I haven't got an update the last couple of days, but I can tell you they're moving fast. And a number of celebrity guest announcements have happened in the last couple of weeks, including the Appalachian Investigators of Mysterious Sightings, or AIMS, or in other words, the guys from the Mountain Monsters television show. They're going to be making their second straight appearance next year. And also celebrity guests Bill Brock and Dr. Jeff Meldrum were announced. But on Thursday, last week after my show was on Tuesday. So on Thursday, Cliff Berakman will be at the 2019 PA Bigfoot Camping Adventure. It was announced on Thursday night. So Cliff from Finding Bigfoot, you're going to have Bill Brock and Dr. Jeff Meldrum. That is quite the celebrity lineup. And that's not including all of the speakers, the 12 speakers, including myself. A lot of other presenters, people doing workshops, and we're going to take you out and we're going to teach you how to look for Bigfoot all at the same time, all in a wonderful weekend. Some movies going to be shown. I'm telling you what, I've never had so much fun at a paranormal themed conference or convention. This is by far the best series I've been to. And the first two were fantastic, even though it was extremely cold and extremely wet. But I'm looking forward to next year. It's going to be extremely fun. And like the tagline says, it's truly the experience of a lifetime. But I say, hey, if you're out in the woods and you're camping, I think it's going to be intense. Because we're going to be intense. Anyway, I'll leave that one alone. But don't forget to check that out. PABigfootCampingAdventure.com. Find it on Facebook at 2019. PA Bigfoot Camping Adventure. Look it up. Find out more about it. Get your tickets today as well as get your campsite soon. So I mentioned, yes, this week we celebrate 10 years of the Paranormal News Insider. And yes, I'm going to get to the news. Don't worry. But I want to reflect quickly just for a moment. Just take a breath and just think about this. 10 years. I mean, think about all the paranormal news show or paranormal shows, I should say. All the interview shows that are out there, I know quite a few that have been around quite a long time. You think about how many have lasted 10 years. Exactly. There's not that many. So I'm extremely honored that I've been able to keep this show going and I've been able to find a home like right here at the Paranormal King Radio Network that I can bring you this show each and every week. And I tell you, it's just... it's not easy to keep doing this stuff. It's a lot of work, especially for me, doing a one-man show and doing all of the research and everything that goes behind this show. But it actually started out back on April 22nd, 2008. Yes, I received an email from a gentleman named Daniel Bouts, who invited me on his show, The Grand Dark Conspiracy, and I was the first guest on this show. And it ended up being for May. And what it was a monthly pre-recorded show. So it was a podcast that was, again, monthly. And he had a couple of other guests, June and July. I believe he had Lloyd Auerbach on there. And Ohio author John Kachuba was the July guest. And Dan emailed me back and said, hey, do you want to come back on? We've had now three ghost guests in a row, and I want to shift the show a little bit in a different direction. So I said, hey, why not? Come on there. We'll talk about cryptozoology. We'll talk about UFOs. We'll talk anything pretty much other than ghosts. So I came back on, and we did that. And during the show, after the show, we talked a little bit more and decided that Dan really wanted to have a paranormal news segment on his show. So the Paranormal News Insider was born, and it debuted that September show on the Grand Dark Conspiracy. So it was a really short. He gave me the reins to do however long I wanted. I think the first few shows were like 5 minutes. Then over time, I went anywhere between 5 and 10 minutes, somewhere a little longer, because he still had guests and he did Campfire Tales. It was a fantastic show. And I stuck with him for quite a long time until he decided to move on. But again, the show was a monthly show for the first 2 years, well, almost 2 years. And so late August of 2010, we went to a weekly format. I was a little nervous about that, not going to lie. I had a lot of time to prepare even for a short show, but I was, again, doing all the production work myself. But we did go weekly, and my gosh, 2011, which was the first full year of doing a weekly show, I did it every single week. 52 shows I did in 2011, and it's the only time I've ever done an entire year worth of Paranormal News Insider shows. But it was a lot of fun being there with Dan and just uploading a pre-recorded segment, which is fun because you can screw it up as many times as you want. Just go back and repatch it and make it look cool. Plus, I added music and sound effects and all kinds of gimmicky things to make it cool. But, you know, it was a lot of fun. But we did miss some time here and there. Show, you know, live radio doesn't always work correctly. And sometimes when you're on networks, things happen. Things happen to networks. They get bought out. They shut down. Different things. So we ended up in 2014. We actually went to AM radio. We were on True Oldies 1270 WQTT out of Marysville, Ohio. Amazing, I still remember that, all that wordage. But yeah, for just over a year, I believe, so 2014. And then Dan expanded the show from one night to 5 nights a week. And our Friday night show was called The Darkest Hours. And I was a co-host of that show on occasion, along with Dave Considine, who's a demonologist, which is kind of cool because him and I are kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum here, but we totally get along with everything. But that run didn't run all that long. June 5th of 2015, there were some shakeups at the ownership at WQTT, and then Dan decided to move the show on before we were basically kicked off, and he never did find another network. And I decided to kind of test the waters, and if he did decide to come back, I would join back up with him. But on September 8th, 2015, I made a standalone debut on a live one-hour segment of my own on what was then called the CJ Mars Radio Network, which became WCJV, and was with them for, let's see, about a year, year and a half, and over 125 shows. Until it shut down, I believe, on April 20th of this year. And I kind of toyed around with coming back or shutting the show down, just maybe doing a couple of standalone shows and then hanging it up. But I had a few very generous offers out there to pick up the show and keep going, keep doing this. And it's just weird. It's a grind. It's a lot more work than what people think to just sit behind a mic for an hour you know, I do a lot of research. I read all these stories, but I do all that anyway. I do all that stuff anyway. Maintaining the website, Facebook, that's all easy stuff. But, you know, putting together a show each and every week, it is a lot of work. It is grind. And, you know, I think over 10 years, you kind of deserve to hang up the mic every now and again. But, you know, I've taken a lot of time off between now and then since starting this show. So, you know, I want to keep plugging away. I want to keep bringing you this show each and every week. And, you know, I've celebrated a lot of milestones over the years. This year was episode 350. Earlier this year, back in February, and my goodness, I can remember my 50th show, and 200 was a huge one back in 2014. So, you know, I'm plugging away. My goal is at least 500, which could take me a little while, but it's one of those goals. I mean, I reached 10 years, which is a huge milestone for me. And I'm very excited to continue to do this. But on that note, like I said, week in, week out. But next week, I'm going to take a week off. So there'll be no live show next week. But I'll be saving up the news for you guys. I might even post some stuff on Facebook. But I'm going to need a week off. It's been a big week. I got a big weekend coming up for myself as well. But I'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. But into the news. Enough about history. Let's look forward. Cryptid news this week. I've been keeping an eye on a couple of stories off and on. One of this Pennsylvania big cat sighting. It's been going. It's been brewing for a while in different parts of PA. And like I said earlier, I was just in Pennsylvania over the weekend, but I frequently go out there to speak at conferences, conventions. I know a lot of great researchers and investigators that work out of Pennsylvania. It's a big hotbed for cryptozoology as well as UFO work. I mean, heck, there's a lot of ghost stuff out there too. But this cat thing has been kind of on the fire here. It's kind of been getting a little bit bigger every now and again. And it finally got the attention of the Coast to Coast camp. So if they're looking at something, it's got to be a pretty big deal. And lately, there's been a lot of mountain lion sightings, like I said, from the eastern half all the way to the western part. Now, these cats are rumored to be mountain lions. There's plenty of pictures and sightings, but not as many good pictures until recently, which is why I'm picking up this story, finally talking about it, because a sighting with nothing to back it up with is just their personal perspective, and it doesn't really provide enough evidence. Unless we have some scat to go along with that, we have some tracks to go along with that. It's just somebody's sighting. But as many of you may know, mountain lions are not supposed to exist east of the Mississippi River, with the exception of southern Florida, where the Florida panthers live. So they're basically extirpated. They're locally extinct for the most part. They're not supposed to be here, although a lot of people have seen them. Now, some cats have managed to move their way east, mostly juvenile males who are in search of their own territory and hopefully a mate. I mean, what are we all here for, right? In 2008, a wandering male from the Black Hills area of South Dakota was struck and killed by a car in Connecticut. And this area was about an hour north of New York City. And that was right after the Eastern Cougar was declared officially extinct. And I'll tell you what, the news went crazy. And a lot of people were very hopeful that this was indeed a Eastern Cougar, however, ended up being one that had wandered from the West, which is still pretty good, and it's inspiring, and it's hopeful that, you know, maybe these cats will work their way east and establish territory. There's a lot of wandering males that have happened over the years. It's basically common knowledge in parts of Canada that they're breeding pairs in Northwest. I shouldn't say Northwest. I guess it's Southwest Canada, just over the state of Maine. So if they're establishing themselves in that area, there's no reason that they can't come down here to the United States. Although there is the Triple S reaction that most U.S. wildlife service agents have, especially in the statewide. And that triple S stands for shoot, shovel, and shut up, which is what they do, unfortunately. So they'll shoot these creatures, they'll bury them, or just get rid of the bodies, and nobody says anything about it. It's really unfortunate. These are fantastic creatures, and they can help balance all these things that deer are doing right now to the eastern states. The deer are just out of control. They eat everything. They cause crop damage. But the states, the states want to make money off of deer hunting. So that's what they're doing. And they don't want hunters afraid to be out in the woods. They don't want that playing field leveled out. For me, I'd love to see one in the wild. That's one of my bucket list type of things. I want to see one of those in the wild. So this latest purported sighting occurred in Clark's Summit, Pennsylvania, which is just north of Scranton in the northeastern part of Pennsylvania. Most photographs of purported mountain lions are generally mistaken identity. You know, they could be anything from a house cat. So this big, fearsome cat that this person described, a lot of times it's just that. It's just a house cat. And it might be a bigger than normal. But if you don't have the proper perspective on this, if it's just walking through grass, it can make it look a lot bigger than what we're seeing, a little fluffy sitting there on our couch, a lot bigger. The cat in the series of this particular photograph from Pennsylvania is there's actually two photographs, and it doesn't seem to be a mountain lion, in my opinion. It has markings on the coat and the inner legs, but the biggest piece of information is the lack of a long tail. So in this picture, and there's a couple of stories like I mentioned, but this one here, you can see this big cat behind a fence. It looks like a fence, and you see kind of a gateway there, and there's right where the tail should be is a big thick piece of pole. So that would be, and there's never a good trail cam picture ever of a big cat, it seems like. It's always obscuring something that you need, some sort of specific detail that would really make it one thing or the other. But here, we're missing that tail. That tail would define it between a bobcat, potentially even a house cat, as well as a mountain lion. But again, it has the markings on the inner legs. So that kind of makes us think that it's the bobcat. Now, a mountain lion has a tail that's about as two-thirds the length of its body. So the cat, or this photograph, it kind of cuts off right where the tail should be sticking out, where the tail would meet with the body. But the fact that there is no tail beyond that interruption point kind of tells me that more than likely this is just a bobcat. And it's unfortunate that you can't see the head. You know, there's never a good picture. Now, bobcats are named bobcats because they have short bobbed tails. And we'll have a coat markings just like the one displayed. So they'll have spots. They have little spots on them, especially on their legs and stuff, where mountain lions are just, they're just tawny colored. Sometimes they're a little darker coat. Sometimes they're brownish to a tan, anywhere in between. The underbody is white. And only small little mountain lions, little cubs up to about 3-4 months old, they'll actually have spots, as well as bright blue eyes, so look really cute. Once about 4 months hits, those stripes pretty much disappear. And this is definitely not a four-month-old mountain lion. Be very, very difficult for a mountain lion to traverse all the way out to that part of Pennsylvania from the Black Hills on its own. And definitely doesn't have the makeup of a baby mountain lion. So this is more than likely a bobcat. Now, if we can only see other aspects, there's more. People always focus on the tail, but there's other aspects, and we'll talk about those other aspects with this similar story out of Maryland. And I'm going to put this link in the chat room, so if you're in the chat room, you'll be able to see this link long before. Well, I shouldn't say long before, because it's going to be out probably tomorrow on regular email. I should say email, through Facebook, regular social medias that I do. I put stuff out on Facebook, and Facebook is tied to Twitter. So Paranews Insider, or at Paranews Insider on Twitter, you can get a hold of me. You can follow along with all these stories and get these pictures of things that I'm trying to describe here, you can check out these links. And, you know, you might see some of these stories. Some of these stories, I do take the leading link, but other times these stories have been copied and pasted so many times around the internet. I like to kind of trace back these stories to some of the original content, or at least local content that has the original information in it, and potentially will be the source of new information if it's put out there right. Yeah, I finally did it right in the chat room. I usually screw it up. So the links are working in the chat room. I'm excited about that. But let's go back to Maryland. Let's get on that little magic bus and drive out to Maryland. So a similar story about trail cam sightings of big cats. Purported mountain lion again here. This is Sykesville, Maryland. A photo created a whirlwind of speculation online, where many were convinced this is definitely a mountain lion. No question about it. The Maryland Department of Natural Resources, they're actually a couple of days late in responding to the story. It kind of grew its own legs and began to run, not literally, but figuratively, in the news feeds, all over Facebook and social media, Instagram, everywhere. It was all over the place. But they did a pretty good job of analyzing the photo. A gentleman named Harry Spiker, the game mammal section leader for the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, stated that spots on the animal's back legs were a dead giveaway in determining what it was. Well, here we go. Same thing. Spots. Now, Spiker said, quote, "There's not a doubt in my mind it's a bobcat," unquote. But again, is that really enough? I'm the kind of researcher that when I see a picture like this, I need more than one detail. I need more than one thing to tie all this together. But, you know, I was pretty surprised that, you know, I guess I'd call him a scientist, would say this. Simple analysis. Because there's actually, in this picture, there's a little bit more to this than the last one. And this picture is the similar side of this creature. It's almost almost a carbon copy of the Pennsylvania one, except instead of a fence, there's some bushes in the way, obscuring, again, where the tail would come out from the body. So again, we have a little bit of confusion here, and this is a black and white trail camera. So yes, back to the stripes. Yes, mature mountain lions do not have stripes, but they can. The cubs do carry these. I said 4 months. I think it's more, it could be up to about 6 months, but it's generally about 3 to 4 months. They start to disappear, but they can carry them about 6 months. It's still not going to be that big of a cat. So yes, that does pretty much eliminate this possibility of the photograph being a mountain lion right there. But we've got a couple of other pieces of identification in this photograph that if you're really paying attention, you can see. One major one that a lot of people don't really look at. They look at the face. They look at the hair around the chin, because the bobcat has a little kind of almost like a little Fu Manchu kind of hair sticking out the side of its head. They look at the tail, and you know, and they look at the fur. But there's the ears. And yes, bobcats have a little hair in their ears, and a lynx will have long hair on the top of the ear. But generally the same, similar shape if you're looking at a trail cam photograph of these, all three of those cats. But a big distinction is seen in this photograph, where in this picture, if you kind of look a little close, you actually see a definitive stripe of white in the top portion of the ear. A majority of mountain lions have a solid black backside of the ear. Some will have light or white areas, but it'll be kind of like a spot. It won't be a stripe. And bobcats always have a white stripe on the back of their ears surrounded by black. So it's black, white, black. It's pretty distinctive. And it's one good way to tell these cats from another if they're facing away from you. And yeah, pretty much one of the knee-jerk reactions over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years or even longer, about any photograph like this You might have said, well, this is just a escaped animal, wandering, escaped mountain lion, somehow, some way got out, got loose. That's usually what people will say, but we had an incident here a few years ago in Ohio where several animals got loose, and unfortunately, all were killed. Over 50 creatures were killed. The gentleman let these animals loose and killed himself. And this was on the outskirts, about 30 miles outside of Columbus, Ohio. So imagine if lions and bears would have gotten to this area. I mean, it could have been really, really bad. So this unfortunate incident in Ohio really led to some laws, not just in Ohio, but a lot of other states as well. And it was a scary thing. And it was Zanesville, Ohio was the location. I was trying to remember the location. So Zanesville, a very scary event. And it just changed a lot of things. But also with the bobcat. The bobcat is becoming a lot more, I don't know. You're seeing a lot more of them here in the East than you ever have. They used to be pretty elusive and pretty rare. But it seems like there's more and more sightings all the time, which is, it's actually kind of good because it means that these large cats are trying to make a comeback. And if the bobcat is a success story, I'm hopeful that the mountain lion can also eventually make its way back east. I'm not going to hold my breath on that one because I think too many people are afraid of it and it's too big of a change for us out here in the East. Now back to this photograph here. And let's see if I can tempt fate and have two stories in a row that actually work in chat. All right, we're going to try this again so you guys can take a look at this picture from this story. And you can see for yourself what I'm talking about here. And, you know, a lot of armchair experts have chimed in on this thing. Wow, two in a row. A lot of people have chimed in on this and given their expert opinion. And some people will claim, oh, this is definitely a mountain lion. Some people will say, well, no, it's definitely not a mountain lion. But again, we look at the tail. This is a third piece. And yes, you can't see a tail on this. And it's, again, the bushes are kind of in the way. But if you look at this picture and you kind of study, if you know the cat, you know what it looks like, you know where the tail's at. you can see several sections of area behind the animal through the bushes. So you can see through these bushes, lots of holes. And these holes are very convenient because they actually will connect to where a mountain lion tail would be hanging or would be flowing behind that creature. And sometimes they do kind of hang down right behind the back legs. So you won't really be able to see it. But it would be able to be visible somewhere in this photograph. I would definitely say you would see it, especially with the cat walking away. They generally flick their tails a little bit, just like your house cat would. So with these three pieces of identification, I would agree. It's definitely not a mountain lion, but it's still awkward because it doesn't really give me 100% bobcat. But I can tell you, I can exclude mountain lion from this, which would lead toward a bobcat explanation. And it's, to me, it's exciting. I love analyzing these things. Trail camera photos like this pop up all the time. And again, I think it's fun. I think it's interesting to kind of play forensic, well, maybe not forensic scientists, but, you know, just kind of analyzing these photos and looking for these details and having to understand these animals for what they are and trying to figure out what they could be. Now, me of all people, I would love to have been a mountain lion, but I have to say I'm not convinced with this photograph. And it's hard to tell size, especially in trail cams. Sometimes trail cams are pretty low, so it makes the animal look a lot bigger than what they are or the way the landscape is. You don't really have the perspective because you don't know how big what you're looking at is in the picture. But for me, I'm working on some projects that's going to help things like that in the future. Maybe not for this particular story, but if I'm out and about, I'm still working on creating my own life-size mountain lion and bobcats, so you can compare them up to areas like this and figure out exactly what you saw. So now we get into Bigfootery. Yes, that's my term for people that research and investigate Bigfoot, because I don't think it's fair to call them cryptozoologists, just a cryptozoologist, because if people are specifying in one area, I think they should be called Bigfooterists. Bigfooterers? I don't know. There's got to be a term out there somewhere. But they're up to Bigfootery. That's all I can tell you. So one of the biggest debates in Bigfootery, other than are they interdimensional or not? Yes. That's a big one. Yes. Why we have no bones? Okay, fine. That's another big one. But what about kill or no kill? That's a pretty darn big one. I'd say that's probably the biggest debate besides the other two things I said. And is the Patterson-Gimlin film legitimate? Well, we'll leave all that for another show. But to kill or not to kill, that is the question. And that's the debate that's been going on for a long, long time. Now, what are the biggest points by skeptics and scientists is that no one has presented a body of Bigfoot, nor has one been found in the wild, or have a living specimen been able to be analyzed. So what do we do about that? Do we all run through the woods with shotguns and blast everything on sight like we did in the 1800s? I mean, a lot of people think we should. A lot of people think that, you know, we've been laughed at, we've been ridiculed, we've been made fun of. Sasquatch has all these commercials. They love them. They take it for real. But here we are out in the woods making these videos, doing all this stuff, speaking at conferences, conventions, and we believe these skeptics don't believe it. But you know darn well that if one is discovered, all the scientists will take credit for it. And the poor cryptozoologists, well, they'll just be selling their old casts on the side of the road. It'll be kind of like a Jurassic Park. You know, when Sam Neill's character drops the claw down the tree, and, you know, that's just the end of it. Who needs to dig up dinosaurs when you have real ones in Jurassic Park? Now, hopefully we don't put these guys in a park situation. But, you know, this is the debate. You know, should we shoot these things? Should we kill one to be able to validate it scientifically? Well, casts aren't enough. DNA hasn't been enough. Hair hasn't been enough. Let's just blast one. But that opens up a whole other can of worms. On the other side of this argument, one of the biggest questions is, what if Bigfoot is closely related to humans? You know, and another question that was brought up to me by a fellow researcher was, what if the Bigfoot is on federal or state land when it's shot? Because you can go to jail for that. You can be arrested for that. You can go to prison for that, for shooting a creature without a license, bagging a creature on the state or federal-owned land. And that's just the tip of the iceberg with this argument here. So an article published by Gizmodo, by Jennings Brown, well, it stirred up a lot of attention last Wednesday. The article opens by talking to Jim Lansdale of the Gulf Coast Bigfoot Researchers Organization. And he is, by the way, if you didn't know, he's the star of the Destination Channel television show called, appropriately enough, Killing Bigfoot. And I would think that from a guy who shows up on a show called Killing Bigfoot, it would be pretty obvious which side of the argument that he sits on. Now, others are not sure killing is really necessary, or even morally, or again, legally correct. I mean, there's a lot of animals that we don't have to kill to prove they exist. Unfortunately, if you look back historically, you know, 1700s, 1800s, even early 1900s, yeah, we killed everything and dissected it. to prove it. And unfortunately, you know, down the road, it's probably going to be necessary to really find out more about these creatures. But I don't think it's necessary to kill one. But that's just my thought on it. I think, you know, maybe even maiming one accidentally, or, you know, hitting it, knocking it out, tranquilizer darts. But all these are very risky things. I'm kidding, of course, because you never want to, you know, we wouldn't want to hurt this creature, especially if it's intelligent here. But there has to be a way other than killing one. But the article also points out that if scientists are wrong and Bigfoot does exist, how do we know what it is or what it isn't? John Kirk, president of the British Columbia Scientific Cryptozoology Club, told Gizmodo in this article, quote, "Nobody knows in totality what a Sasquatch is. It certainly has facets of, it reminded me very much of the genus Homo, which is what we're all descended from. Supposing it is indeed, does have DNA that indicates that it's a close relative of ours, well, you have a moral quandary right there, right away, and a very serious legal and judicial quandary. Because if you kill something that is genus Homo, by the very definition of the word, you committed homicide." Unquote. Lansdale, meanwhile, is also concerned about providing credible proof to scientists. So his approach is a little more straightforward, as he says, quote, "Our mission is to discover." "Our mission is discovery. And by discovery, I mean the only way that scientists will say, yes, this is an animal, is if they have a body. And so that was our mission, to harvest a body and take it to science." Unquote. Yeah, his words, harvest a body. Wow. Well, he goes on to try and justify his brutal viewpoint by saying, quote, "The bleeding hearts, they don't really know about the animal itself. They've got this beat into their head that this is a human-type hybrid, and it's not. It's some type of primate that we have, a North American ape that's been here forever. There's people that claim there's only a breeding population, that there are only 2,000 to 3,000. They're not out doing what we do. They're sitting behind a desk, and we're out in the woods," unquote. So I don't know what he's trying to say there, because if it is a, if it's a type of primate, I don't know if he knows that we're kind of closely related to primates. But he might have wanted to sit a little longer in science class there. But it's still not excusing us from these potential ramifications, legally and morally, from shooting a creature that we have no idea what it could be or made up of. Because, you know, it's cool to blame somebody for their lack of perspective because they sit behind a desk. But it's, you know, we also have to consider too much time out in the woods. You kind of don't really realize that sometimes these things could be, like was put in here, a legal quandary. Now, the article continues with viewpoints from one of the most respected cryptozoologists in the field, Lauren Coleman, who looks at the past as an understanding of why we're at this current crossroads. Benjamin Radford, a deputy editor of Skeptical Inquirer, also weighs in with his viewpoint on both sides of the equation, giving an understanding why each field feels strongly that they are right about the situation. So yeah, we're both right. The pro-kill and the anti-kill, we all have our own perspectives. And there's a reason for each one. And for me, you know, I see both sides. I'm not saying that one side is wrong and one side is right. I do see the need for validation, but that doesn't mean that we have to be cold-blooded and go out there and commit premeditated murder or execution of an animal. It's so elusive. It's so mysterious. So, you know, why trying to blast it, you know, when we could probably attempt to capture it somehow, I'm sure. You know, while I would be appalled by the murder of a Bigfoot, Honestly, again, I wouldn't have much of a problem with one being captured. Now, I wouldn't want to see one injured to the point of where it would not be able to live in the wild if we did something to it. Now, if one were hit by a car, which would be the most logical potential for one to be discovered, that's how we find mountain lions. That's how we find a lot of other animals that we know that they're in certain areas. I mean, that's why we have signs everywhere where deer cross. Just so you know, deer crossing signs are not put there to tell deer where to cross the road. Yes, there's actually people out there that believe that. Deer crossings are put up in areas where high deer traffic is seen or cars have hit multiple deer on different occasions. I just kind of put that out there because I know there's somebody out there that's going, are you serious right now? But yeah, that's how it works. But these do happen. Cat collisions happen all the time. And I think that this is going to be our best bet to ever find a specimen. And if it's going to happen, it's going to happen anytime now. You know, there's been a lot of rumors about this stuff. You know, trucks, semis hitting Bigfoot, but you never find a body or anything like that. It's usually just a story concocted. You know, but even then, you know, I'm worried that if we do validate this, we do find a body, what comes next? Because everyone with a shotgun, everyone with a dream of having their own Bigfoot hanging on the wall, they're all going to be out there trying to get their own. And there would be a lot of legal things that would erupt based on this. It would be a massive distraction from the scientific world. It would be kind of cool because then we could just go, ha, told you so. But the reality of things, though, is if one of these creatures were to exist in the wild, we would sooner or later find a body either in the woods or struck by a vehicle, like other animals and even humans have been hit. So, you know, the longer time goes by, a lot of people say it's any minute now. But I think the longer the time goes by, I'm a little bit more and more doubtful that there's really something out there. But you have to hold out hope. You have to believe because you never want to stop believing in these things. But, you know, let's just let nature run its course here. I think that's the only way we're going to allow this stuff to happen. Yay. All right. So that's your Bigfoot news, your Bigfootery section of the cryptid news. I got one last story that kind of just snuck in coming out of the holiday weekend. The International Cryptozoology Museum was home to the International Cryptozoology Conference 2018 that took place over the Labor Day weekend. And during the conference, the announcement for Cryptozoologist of the Year was made. And no, it wasn't me. I don't think I've ever been close in the voting. But this year's Cryptozoologist of the Year is a professor at Oxford Brookes University in Anthropology and Primate Conservation, studying the unique group of evolutionary distinct primates known as Asian lorises. This year's winner of the 2018 Golden Yeti, which represents the Cryptozoologist of the Year, is none other than Dr. Anna Nakaris. Now, Dr. Anna Nakaris has a background in primate field research and also a very steep interest in cryptozoology, along with her, she has an ability to educate the public. She's done some TED Talks, is all over YouTube, and a lot of her, her Yeti work is on there as well. And it's one thing to be a researcher and to go out there and discover things and make new discoveries. But it's also another thing to be able to connect with the general public and do this. So, you know, hats off to her, Dr. Anna Nakaris, the 2018 Cryptozoologist of the Year, as recognized by Lauren Coleman of the International Cryptozoology Museum out of Portland, Maine. I think she's an easy choice for this year's honor, and a very good one. Now, last year was Seth Breedlove, who has made a number of documentaries. And in case you're wondering, guess he's going to be at the 2019 PA Bigfoot Camping Adventure. See what I did there. UFO news. Got some crazy stuff happening out in California. They're losing their minds a little bit more than normal, I think, out there in California. Several UFO videos, and by several, I mean dozens of videos have been popping up on social media from last Wednesday night from the San Diego, California area. The videos focused on a string of bright yellowish-white lights that seemed to hang in the sky horizontally. Normally, you would say airplanes, but way too packed, and they just kind of hung there in the sky. As some recorded the footage, suddenly another string of lights appeared above the other. And that's when people began to lose their minds and also publish stuff on social media. Because, you know, the Earth may be coming to an end. We may be being invaded by aliens. But I'll be darned if I'm not going to get likes and people, you know, putting little hearts and getting some stats off of my video as the Earth comes to an end. But that's what happens. That's the kind of era we live in, unfortunately. Social acceptance. We have to be accepted by others on similar media. Anyway, local news stations were just as perplexed as those sending in the video and rumors, and the speculation was running rampant. However, it didn't take too long for the truth to be discovered. According to the local CBS 8, the flares were from the Marine Aerial Refueler Transport Squadron 352, or Squadron VMGR 325, a.k.a. the Raiders. They're part of the Marine Aircraft Group 11, MAG 11, the third of the 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing, and provide both fixed-wing and rotary-wing aerial refueling capabilities to support Fleet Marine Force air operations, in addition to assault air transport of personnel, equipment, and supplies. They were conducting flare training about 30 miles off the coast of San Diego. But of course, you know, the military wanted to squash this rumor. But of course, with this admittance, led to even further speculation. Granted, a lot of people felt that, wow, they never admit this stuff, so it's got to be a cover-up. I mean, flares equals cover-up. But I think sometimes we have to take things at face value. If you see this video or series of videos, there's so many out there already, it's kind of ridiculous. And it's, again, another one of those stories that I was going to sidestep because I cover these a lot. I talk about a lot of these mistaken identity type of videos that happen all the time out there with these flares or these paratroopers. It happens quite frequently. But, you know, when they become as viral as this, you kind of got to step in. I kind of have an obligation to jump in there and say, enough is enough. And this is what's going on. But definitely, I don't think a cover-up is at play here. It seems to be pretty legitimate on that analysis. And, you know, also admittance. That looks like flares to me. So ghost news. I guess you could call this an interesting story. I don't know if I was more mad or found this humorous or just concerning. Now, it's almost 5 years ago that five so-called ghost hunters burned down the historic LeBeau Plantation in Louisiana. But this year, 53-year-old Jolynn Wynn seemingly decided to pay homage to that incident by almost burning down her own home. For her, it wasn't because the house here didn't show any ghosts to her. That's why the so-called ghost hunters and burned down the LeBeau Plantation. That, and they had a mixture of alcohol and marijuana. But they didn't see any ghosts, so they were a little mad about that. So they burned down the plantation. But here, Jolynn didn't do that because of that. She thought her couch was possessed. So you burn down your house. I guess that's what you do. I guess that's the normal reaction. Now, the couch was not only thought to be possessed. I mean, that's one thing, you know, to have something possessing your couch. But it was possessed by the devil itself. Yes, the couch was possessed by the devil. So Jolynn did what I suppose anyone else would do in this particular individual situation. She lit it on fire while it was still in her mobile home. Not sure what kind of accelerant she used or if she just lit a match and laid it on the couch. I don't know how it happened. But she intentionally set fire to her couch, and the couch damaged part of the home. And after the blaze was put out by firefighters, the woman was arrested and charged with arson once it was realized that it was she who started the fire. Hopefully the couch gets proper counseling, and Jolynn can maybe not going to lay on that couch to see somebody's help, but hopefully they're both going to be okay. And as far as I'm what I've heard, the devil was not injured in that incident whatsoever. Yikes. Anyway, that's your ghost news. I got one last story here I'm going to cram in here real quick. It's an IFO story. It's an IFO story. Well, I got to tempt fate here and try to do another link, see if this one works in the chat room. So if you're not in the chat room, you're missing out. There's some great conversation going on. Some editorializing every now and again, a question on what I'm talking about or what's going on. And I'm sharing all these stories as I talk about them. And if you're missing these links, I get it. Sometimes people can't listen live or be in a chat room live. But I will be putting these links out there, again, on social media throughout the week after the show is done, probably pretty much starting tomorrow. I'll be putting these links out one or maybe two a day. I don't like to inundate you guys with too much stuff, especially if something is breaking. I want to put that out there, and I want you to look at everything I put. I'm not going to put 20 links out there a day. I don't want to inundate you with news or information. The Facebook website, again, Paranews Insider, you can look for it. And it's tied together with my Twitter, so at Paranews Insider for Twitter as well. You know, we all have our favorite type of social media. Me, pretty much I could do without all of it, but we kind of don't have a choice. In other news, yes, an IFO, in other words, identifiable flying objects. What's going to be a UFO, either way. And I'm surprised it hasn't popped in. I put this story on in my news here, but so far I really haven't seen much in the way of it. But I do watch the skies. I do pay attention to a lot of these astronomical things, as well as we've had pretty much a record number of meteor sightings this year, and it's been building over the last few years. A lot of people are concerned about volcanic activity and seismic activity. Seems to be on the increase, you know, along with all these hurricanes and things that are happening. But I don't think it's all related. I think it's all pretty much random. But I'll tell you what, when you do step back and you look at it all together as a whole, it is a little unnerving. It's a little scary. That seems like a lot of larger meteors are falling. We're not getting too much of an announcement about prior to these big things hitting the Earth. We just had this giant asteroid that was about a million miles away. It passed by us. I think it was right after the show last week, like that night, like 2 or 3 hours after the show ended. Nothing happened. I think there were some really scant pictures through telescopes, but it wasn't even close. You know, we didn't feel it. We didn't see it. I didn't block out the moon or anything. It was well past the moon, so really no threat whatsoever. But again, one of those that they only had a couple of days or a couple of weeks notice that this thing was in the neighborhood. So it's a little unnerving. Again, all these major earthquakes we've had, it's actually fairly normal. But then you tie in some of these volcanic activity, it's a little weird. Nothing to panic about. But last Monday, there was a meteor sighting, created over 300 initial reports, which is pretty rare. The fireball fell over Missouri at around 8:40 p.m. on Monday, August 27th. The sighting reports came in from multiple surrounding states, including Kansas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, and Nebraska. The meteor fell at a shallow angle and was visible for a few seconds, which did provide credible witnesses to the event, as well as a lot of closed-circuit cameras capturing this event. But again, one can only wonder how many reports will roll in of an unidentified flying object. But so far, I haven't seen any of the usual suspects taking these some of these videos and saying it was a UFO or anything like that. So pretty much passed, I would say, without incident. And I think we're pretty good on that. So that's it. Nothing really like earlier this year where something caught fire and people thought it was the meteor that landed. Nothing like that. It's one of your leading stories of the year so far. And we'll put that in the chat room. And again, don't worry. Get those links out to you throughout the week. And again, as always, if you have any information about any paranormal conference or convention, let me know. That's not on that list. I do the best I can to keep up with stuff and do my best to try to mention some of them on the show here. But there's been a lot of news lately this year, so it's been kind of hard to get to them. But again, you'll see it on the website. If you want your convention or you know of one that you're going to go to and it's legit, let me know at insider@paranewsinsider.com or click on the contact link in there, and I'll get it on for you on the website. For me, yeah, I do have a Halloween gig. I'll be, what day is that? I got to check. You know, it's one of the greatest things about having your own website. So I have briandparsons.com. That's pretty much the only way I can keep track of all my appearances is by putting on a website. So that website is really not so much for me to brag about all my stuff that I'm doing, let alone as it is a nice little reference for myself. I'll actually be at the Westerville Public Library on October 30th. So that's the night before Halloween, the peak of the silly season. And that will also be, speaking of 10 years, that's going to be my 10th consecutive year at that particular library, which is, again, another huge milestone, I think, to be able to speak at the same library for 10 years. And, you know, I wouldn't have been hurt or shocked if they would have said, hey, we want to do something else next year, a few years ago, even after the first or second year I did speak there, because, you know, variety is nice. And I have changed every year. I've changed what I've spoken about and done things from different angles and viewpoints. So obviously, hopefully I'm doing something right, but I'm looking forward to that in October. But that being said, yeah, there's no show next week, so I won't see you next week, or I wouldn't have seen you anyway, because I can't see you in the chat room. I mean, I could see names and things, but it's not really you. It's a projection of your person, I guess. But I will see you in 2 weeks. Again, no show next week on, I guess it would be September 11th. No, not because of it's September 11th, but just taking a week off. But for now, I'll see you in 2 weeks. And keep your eyes in the skies, your ears in the woods, and the hair standing on the back of your neck. And always keep your mind slightly ajar. Don't let your brains fall out. And above all else, don't stop believing. For the Paranormal News Insider, this is Dr. Brian D. Parsons reporting.